I used to think something was wrong with me, that I liked suffering. I liked things being hard. And now I understand that by going through those things and pushing myself past being physically strong, but to where I have to be really mentally strong, that's where I get into suffering and overcoming it. And then you get the flip side of that, which is I think a greater depth of appreciation for a success, or even if it's a failure, it's a greater appreciation for the people you're climbing with and for the sunrise and all these little things that make climbing really special to me.
Welcome to the Stokecast, where each week we bring you an inspiring athlete, adventurer, or entrepreneur and dig into their stories and strategies for balancing work, life, and adventure while having fun and making a difference. I'm Jonathan Ronzio.
And I'm Emily Holland. Thanks for joining us today.
Let's get to it.
Today we have a pretty rad woman on the Stokecast, Hillary Nelson. She is the first person to do a lot of things, but most recently her and Jim Morrison skied the Lhotse Kular, and we're going to fact check my pronunciation of Lhotse there, I think. Right, Jonathan?
I mean, I think that you're fine. I don't need to fact check anything. It works for me.
We're good on the fact check. So we fact checked it and we looked through all the numbers and that's how you pronounce it. So Hillary was great. I'm stoked to talk to her, as I'm stoked to talk to all of our guests.
And you're stoked to say stoked on the Stokecast? You always try to avoid that, actually.
I do. I'm just going to give in to it. It's my new thing for 2019. I'm just going to give in to the stoke.
There you go.
Yeah.
Give in to the impulses. No, it was awesome, awesome conversation. We were chatting with Hillary, of course, about the Lhotse Kular. And, I mean, it's a 7,000-foot, like, dream line, right? It's crazy.
Whose dream?
Anybody who can tackle it, I guess.
Yeah.
Not many can, but
looks
but
cool.
it was her dream line.
Yeah.
Maybe most people's nightmare line.
I'm like, it seems
but
like
But no,
nightmare.
We talk about that, about making the dream a reality, about the lifelong approach to it, not just like from when they decided to go do it, but and the lead up to that, but the lifelong passion and approach to making that happen, and everything else going on in her world with the North Face team. And I mean, I don't want to give too much away on this, but likely everybody knows that she just took the torch from Conrad Anker.
Oof, that's a lot, but I think she's going to do great. Sounds really amazing. Well, we're not going to give anything else away. There you go. You can have that and just listen to this amazing interview with Hillary Nelson.
Hillary, so good to have you on the Stokecast. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
I am really good. How are you guys tonight?
Amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. I was going to say doing great, but amazing captures it well.
I'm freezing, actually. I'm home in Telluride, Colorado, and it has been a balmy like 2 degrees every morning.
Oh my gosh.
Yikes.
It is so cold. Yeah. Oh. So I should be used to being cold. You would think I would be used to it, but I'm not. I'm never quite ready for it.
No. I mean, unless you're like gearing up and getting ready mentally and physically to like, you know, get into the cold, I feel like I'm the same way. Like I don't mind negative 15 if I'm ready for it, but otherwise, like, in a blanket by the fire.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like I'm probably coldest when I'm going to my car from my house than any other time when I'm like out in the mountains in the winter.
Right, because you're trying to just sneak through and maybe you don't put that jacket on or the hat and it's like, it's cold.
Right? Has it been dumping snow out there?
You know, it's actually been quite good. We don't have a ton of snow, but if you want to compare it to last year, it's winter, and I'm so grateful for that. This time last year, it was 65 degrees, and the grass was green, and there was no winter. So I have snow on my front porch. The ski area is open. And that's all I can ask for. I think everybody in town is pretty psyched to see snow. So, and it's supposed to start snowing all week. So that's another benefit.
That's exciting.
That's fantastic. It's been the same out here for the past couple of years. It's been like, I think 2 years ago I was paddleboarding in shorts on Christmas.
And this week, scary.
It's so scary. I mean, it was fun on that day, and it was like I was wearing like a jacket and a Santa hat and shorts, and it was like very weird.
But there's like a pit in your stomach. Yeah. You're kind of like, this is good for the moment, but I know this means something much worse.
Right.
Exactly. If you can just focus on that instant, you're having an awesome time, and it's so cool. Such a novelty to do that in December. But then when you actually start to really think about it, it's not that great.
Totally. But I do think we're in the same boat on the East Coast here. I think we're expecting like 2 or 3 feet up in New Hampshire this week.
Oof. This is really...
be traveling to Pittsburgh tomorrow, and I have a feeling I'm going to get caught in a snowstorm.
Uh-oh.
This has turned into a good weather report from the Stonecast.
Yeah, right?
So thanks, Hillary. No, just kidding.
No problem. So long as it, maybe we're like, we'll induct winter by talking about it.
Maybe. Well, speaking of winter, so... Obviously, we know that you're a skier, but you just came back from quite an incredible feat expedition, if you will. Do you want to start there and tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I just got back, the first week of October, so a month and a half ago, and spent about 5 weeks in Nepal with my life partner, climbing partner, Jim Morrison, and we... kind of tackled something that had been really an obsession of mine for a long time, a decade even, longer maybe, and same for him. We came at it from different places, but we were able to climb and ski Lhotse, which is connected to Everest on its north shoulder, Everest south shoulder, and ski the Lhotse Kuar, which had never been skied before, and it starts just below 28,000 feet, and I don't know, it was rad. It was so...
Oh my God.
And that's...
It was so good. It was cool.
That's like a 2,000-foot couloir almost, right? And a 7,000-foot line?
Total line is 7,000 feet. You're in the Kuar, for like 1,800 feet, and then it kind of spits you out onto the Lhotse face, which is... like as opposite of a couloir as you can get. It's just this big, massive, it's got to be a half a mile wide, this huge face that's really steep and sustained for 5,000 feet.
Wow.
That is wild. So what kind of pitch is sustained? I mean, you skied off the summit. So like, was it kind of like a blind roll in, or it kind of described the going into that and how steep it stays for so long?
The summit was definitely a blind roll in and was really steep, probably some of the steepest turns on the whole thing. I'd say it got close to 60 degrees, but it was soft, this like weird kind of rotten sugar snow. So when you turn, you sink all the way in. And then after that, it fluctuated between... 45 and maybe a little over 50 degrees. So probably averaging 48 to 50 degrees for the whole rest of the face. And the couloir has this kind of pinch that narrows and gets really steep in there. So, you had to be on it the whole time, but
wow.
But it was, the snow was enough that you could, you could take a lot of rests and you could even kind of lay down on your side and catch your breath. All that kind of, so it was just very, you're just looking all the way down to the bottom the whole time. So that part's pretty intense.
Wow.
Yikes.
Well, so, okay. So this is the most recent thing that's happened, but I kind of want to, and then I know I asked this question, but I want to take a step back and kind of understand the mindset of someone. No, you have too many questions about this couloir.
I want to know more about this. So, just one more question. Did you actually climb up the same route? Like, what was your route to the top? Because I know approaching any kind of line like that, it's often good to climb it so you know what kind of snow you're dropping into.
Yeah, we did. We climbed up the route, the exact route, pretty much the exact route that we skied down. Once we got out of the couloir and onto the Lhotse face, we went away from our uphill track, but we could see what the snow was like, so it was fine. But we climbed up what we skied down.
Okay, solid. Good info for our listeners, right?
Do you want any more?
No, that's all the questions for now. I'm going to have lots more. Yeah. But let's, Emily, mindset, go.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think. So you said you've had this kind of on your radar for quite a few years now. And so maybe taking a step back and understanding where you're coming from right, the Pacific Northwest where you grew up to being this person who wants to go after something like that and what that drive is from.
Well, I mean, I'm a ski mountaineer, which right there is like possibly one of the most obscure sports out there. So, I mean, that immediately sort of lends itself to a small group of people that are really dedicated ski mountaineers. And then that further, you know, like any sport, there's sort of lines, there's goals within that community. There's things that are really respected. There are things that are really remote. There are, you know, the test pieces, all different kind of ways to build up to what I think is sort of one of the ultimate high altitude ski lines. And I mean, I've been doing this for almost 20 years professionally. So that tells you how long. I mean, I'm old to begin with, but I hate that. But I feel like I still feel strong, so I'm gonna keep at it. But
please do.
I don't know. I guess the best way to relate it would be from the very first expedition I ever went on was in 1999. This was a long time ago, and I was in India, and I remember a friend of mine pointing out this peak called Hapsur. I didn't know what it was called at the time. And I had this little like 4x6 photo of it. And at that time I was in my early 20s and looking at this mountain was just like, there is no way I will ever be able to do that. And I just really dug my nails into the sport and spent years learning and trying all different kind of test pieces. I found myself really suited to high altitude. And eventually I was able to go back and actually climb and ski that line. And that is sort of the same story with Lhotse. It's something that I saw and thought was beyond my reach. And I then have a tendency to obsess and work really hard and figure out how to make it within my reach. And it's not always great for the people who have to live with me and around me. I get those things stuck in my head. But it's just time and there's a lot of luck to it. And a little bit of obsession, I guess, is what got me there.
Now, even still, when you go back and look at some of these peaks on these expeditions, or even going to Lhotse and looking up at it for that trip, when you have prepared, you've put in the time and you were working towards it, did you kind of still feel that, like, that there's no way thing? Because, like, I mean, I've done Rainier, but every time I go back to splitboard it, I look at it and I'm like, no way. Like, yeah. Even still.
I mean, if you go back to your question about climbing up the route to ski down Lhotse, for example, I mean, we were probably less than an hour from the summit and I was still not convinced it was going to happen. I was still like, oh my gosh, so much can go wrong in the hour between it being here and being on the summit. And I think it's not always healthy to approach a climb like that. It's sort of self-defeating, but in some way, the way my brain works, it's also motivating to prove that part of my brain wrong and be like, no, you got to keep pushing. That's how you make this happen. You keep trying, like, you know, staying within a healthy realm of risk. You keep pushing and you keep trying, and you really are your own champion for making it happen. And I think that is probably what I've learned the most through all the expeditions and things that I've done, is that it's really easy to give up and you're not always doing it for the right reasons. And so, yeah, I kind of go through this whole mental circus, and it's more that mentality than it is the physicality to sort of be successful, I think. Sorry, my phone just beeped.
That's all right. Well, you brought up a great point right there. Like, how do you balance the side of your brain that is saying, push it, this is what you need to do to get there, and you can do this, versus the side that, you know, the risk management side? Like, what does healthy room for risk look like for you?
I mean, that's something that is a very, very much of a balancing act. You know, Emily, you said you talked about balance early on, but like balancing, like I'll never say my life is in balance, but when it comes to like the moment of climbing and being on a mountain, oh my God, everything is beeping. Sorry. when it comes to that moment, there really is sort of that sweet spot where you're pushing yourself, and there's risk, because it's not worth it if there isn't. I wouldn't say it's not worth it, but you're there for the risk taking. I mean, that's the whole foundation of the trip, is you're taking a risk. You're taking a risk at trying this new thing or this new line or doing something a different way. That inherently is risky. And so then it's just a matter of absorbing the risk. And I think it's also time and experience that helps you assess it really quickly and in the moment. And that not only is everything that's happening outside of me, but also what's happening inside of me physically. And just being able, it's hard even to explain it. I'm so familiar with it. Sometimes it's just a gut feeling that you have to turn around, and I don't have a good explanation for why. I just don't want to be there anymore, and I'll end an expedition or turn around or do anything to get out of that spot. And then in other cases, I have the confidence, even if the risk is high, and I'm willing to keep pushing through. So yeah, that is a balancing act, and it's one that requires a lot of presence.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you're saying, so you're looking up at these mountains or these couloirs or these lines and saying, there's no way I can do that. But even saying that, then you go back and you are obviously putting in some level of work to, maybe it's not solely to get to that peak or to that, you know, line or whatever it is, but it's obviously moving towards that. So it's interesting that you're almost challenging, you're like challenging yourself by saying that. And then
yeah,
proving yourself wrong. And every time that you go, and wow, that's, I got to use that a little bit more. I think that might work on me.
It's just like, it's like being your own like Freud or something. I don't even know which.
I like it. I like that way of thinking, because I think that's also like, you know, I don't necessarily want to put words in your mouth, and you can, you know, say anything else here, but like, you know, it's, I think it's oftentimes hard for, well, we don't have a lot of role models as women, or maybe when you started out, right, 20 years ago, you said you've been doing this. Who did you have to look to say, okay, well, like, she's doing it, I can do it too. So I feel like that self-doubt may have been a little bit about that. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think in large part, yes, I agree that when I started this, you know, there really weren't a lot of female role models exactly in what I'm doing. And I was, but a huge part of it too is just not knowing myself, mm-hmm. and knowing the capabilities that I have, it's tough like describing the independence, because a lot of it also does depend on your team. But it took me a long time to get to a place where I just had my own opinions about a route or certain conditions or the day we wanted to climb, weather, whatever it is, the technicalities of the gear we were using. It totally took me a long time to figure out how how to be my own competitor.
Yeah.
If that's the right word.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, and to be able to trust. I mean, I'll throw my kids in there, basically having kids and being pregnant and going through labor and having my body do these things that were not in my control, but almost being an outside observer and seeing how much pain you can actually withstand and how much you can adapt to situations. It really has given me incredible confidence in climbing. It seems like a crazy source for confidence, but it really,
It seems like a perfect source for confidence. I mean, I think it's like when you go, whether through an expedition or a race or anything that you go through, that you push your body past the point of pain, and mentally it's like physically you think that you should stop, but mentally you just keep pushing forward. And I cannot say anything in the realm of pregnancy, but can
right.
can
but
imagine. Yeah, like that's a perfect comparison for being able to draw, you know, draw and drive motivation. Because like when I was like caught in a bay last winter kayaking and thought like I was going to get caught in the current and my hands were going to freeze. It was like mid-December and there were waves crashing over my kayak. And all I kept thinking about was the last hardest thing I did, Denali. And I was like, you can get through this.
Right.
So I can imagine you can point back to a number of different things, pregnancy and giving birth included, to be like, no, Hillary, you got this.
Yeah, and that is a huge part of it. And a lot of it, it's from that part of my life, and it's also from different expeditions. It's from personal relationships I've had that I've suffered in and found my way through all of those things. I wouldn't say I channel, that's maybe a little too strong, but like I use when I'm climbing and it is when I get to those moments of doubt, I'm like, dude, I've got this. Like you have this depth of experience and I know enough about myself now that I used to think something was wrong with me, that I liked suffering. I liked things being hard. And now I understand that by going through those things and pushing myself past being physically strong, but to where I have to be really mentally strong, that's where I get into suffering and overcoming it. And then you get the flip side of that, which is I think a greater depth of appreciation for a success, or even if it's a failure, it's a greater appreciation for the people you're climbing with and for the sunrise and all these little things that make climbing really special to me.
Wow.
One thing that you touched on was that like you weren't sure how much of it was like individual about you or you know, credited to the team that you were with. And I'm curious how much credit you give the people around you or the relationships that you've built or pursued or whatever to where you've gotten. Because I know like that some of the things I would have never done without finding the right people who were just as crazy as me, if not crazier, right? And it's a matter of right. of being in the right place or, you know, taking the initiative or just to surround yourself with people who will push you.
Yeah. I mean, I think in my life there are two categories of people that have really like helped me and influenced me and allowed me to be who and what I am. Because I'm not always, I mean, nobody is always an easy person. I'm not easy. I have to move all the time. I can be incredibly like singularly focused. But the first group of people are the ones that I'm home with, like my friends and my family, that are very understanding in those realms, that support me even though they think what I'm doing is totally insane or crazy, or, you know, they support me, especially in probably the most guilt-ridden part of my life. And that's like, you know, leaving my kids to go climb a mountain. That seems crazy and hard, and yet somehow I can adapt and I can do it. And I have people in my life that support me in that. And then there's the people that I climb with, and that has been a huge influence in my life, because it's expanded my perspective of what is normal and what is possible. And just having that door open and kind of seeing the light through that crack really lets me push myself, and my crazy ideas aren't crazy to everyone. And then I get to go and climb with these people, and, you know, sometimes the team dynamics don't work, and there's so much to learn from that, and just as much as there is to learn from the team dynamics that do work. And I think it's all those influences that I've been very lucky to have in my life. I think at some point, I don't know, hopefully I can return that to some of the upcoming, you know, climbers and skiers and adventurers that are out there, because I don't think I would be where I am without having had that in my life.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly good point, like that you have to have the support system in the foundation, and then you have to have people who are like pushing you along, or that you're helping to push along. I think that's amazing. And so in that kind of wanting to do that for, you know, other people in the community or people who are coming up, I mean, you have quite the impressive resume of feats, if you will, now, and I'm sure you're not done yet, of course. So, I mean, you're doing these things, and you're the first woman to climb to 8,000 meters in 24 hours, right? Everest and Lhotse. And that was, what year was that now? It was a while ago.
Well, that was a little while, yeah.
Yeah. And so you, and obviously you're the most recent, that's a first as well. And that's just first people, right? You and Jim were the first people to do that, which is great. And I think that, or do you think that rather these types of firsts and these types of pushing the boundaries are enabling those people in the community to push themselves as well and add another layer to, I guess, the sport overall?
Yeah, I really do, because I know from my own experience that seeing people push the boundaries, Lynn Hill, Conrad Anker, there's, you know, many of them out there, even looking at what Alex Honnold does and Emily Harrington. Like, I feel like I have so many people that I can draw inspiration from, and if they help me see things in a different light, then hopefully through the avenues I'm taking and the style I'm trying to do things in, that's helping others sort of see things differently and pursue things in their own unique way.
So you brought up a name there, Conrad Anker, and to the tune of being a mentor for the younger generation or being a leader in a way, you know, you are now the team captain for the North Face athlete team, right? You took the torch from Conrad.
I took the torch from Conrad. We were just at the North Face Athlete Summit, and it was actually in Puerto Rico, which was really cool, and it wasn't quite a literal like torch handing over, but it was pretty close. It was really fun. And I'm excited. Conrad's been doing it for a very long time, and so they're big shoes to fill. But I just think I'm at a place in my life where I'm really excited about all the new crazy things that are happening, not only in my sport, but just in exploration in general. And so to have this platform and to, I don't know, share that with people looking for a door into this world, and also, you know, just through my own exploits. I'm really excited about it.
Nice. So in the before the recording, I think we talked about Team Captain. We were like, oh, it seems like high school again, right? But so what is, so what does that actually mean for the North Face? Like, what does that entail?
And for you.
And for you.
Yeah, what does it mean?
Well, you know, I keep referring to it as like, oh my gosh, I have like a real job all of a sudden. But it's something that's still very much to be crafted. Conrad sort of invented the position and so naturally just filled his role as a facilitator between the brand, the North Face, and the athletes, and crafting this team that I think is really special. And so I think what the biggest undertaking for myself and for sort of the people at the North Face who deal with the athlete team, et cetera, is really defining the job actually, and how it will unfold in the years to come in terms of what does it mean to be the North Face captain. And a lot of that is, you know, spending a lot more time in the office with the managers of the different athletes and helping find and source new athletes for the team, and just listening to stories and being there for questions and ideas and a sounding board. So it's hopefully pretty organic and fun, I think, is a good word to say for it. I don't know. I'm excited about it. I'm excited to find out what it is and to help create what it is.
I'm sure.
That is one of the most unique jobs I think I've ever had. It's like the coolest thing ever.
No, that's so cool. I mean, from a onlooker's perspective, I think one of the coolest things I've seen Conrad doing in I don't know, the last decade is just like pulling new faces into big expeditions with like people that you already know, right? And it's like a way to discover new people by like connecting the community.
Right. And I think the best thing about that is, and North Face has a long history of mentoring, but what I've learned from, you know, seeing Conrad do this and sort of having him as a mentor for me for a long time is that, you know, now that I'm in that mentor position, with kind of quotations, because I feel like it's such a two-way street, and it's such an opportunity for me to also see things differently through some of the younger, newer athletes that are on the team, and just sort of like regain excitement. And I mean, a really good example was on this Lotse expedition. We had two filmers with us, and you know, they're 30 and they had never been into the Khumbu before, and this was kind of like a stretch given their previous climbing experience. And it was so like enlightening having them be there, because they were so excited about everything that they saw. And it was this, you know, the light on the shoulder of Everest, the way the icefall flowed down into the Khumbu, like all these things were just mesmerizing for them, and there's no way to escape it, like bringing that newness back into my own vision instead of, you know, being like, oh yeah, I've been there, seen that. You know, on one hand, you're helping these guys navigate high altitude climbing and all the hard things that go with it, and then on the other hand, they're just like totally creating the stoke basically, and the excitement, and like that humming energy. And it was a huge part of like I think why we were successful.
It's like the fountain of youth. Love it.
It's great. It's awesome.
I really feel like adventure sports are the fountain of youth. I remember living in Aspen and seeing Klaus Obermeyer on like the hill, just crushing it in his 90s, and feeling I mean, when you get out there in the mountains, it keeps you young.
I think it really does. It's the fresh air. It's your body is always in motion. You are meeting new people. It mixes up your day, and it does. It keeps you young and sane. Keeps you sane.
So, I mean, with all of this going on, one thing I want to talk to you about and prod at a little is, like, you know, you have this new position that you're kind of figuring out within the North Face team, leading the North Face team. You have, you're a mother with two boys and have a family, and yet also this, like, incredibly ambitious, accomplished outdoor athlete. Like, how are you kind of balancing all these different aspects of your life? And speaking to the most recent expedition from Lhotse, and the decompression that comes from that, and the wind up and ramp down in the media period, and then, like, the next expedition, whenever that becomes a thing that pops into your mind, like, what is going on in your head to handle all this?
That is a good question. It's funny because I really used to say, like, I used to talk about how good I was at, like, oh, you just really, you have to work these things and you keep everything in balance. And I think as I've gotten older and I've gotten better at sort of seeing myself in reality, I don't have great balance at all. And I think I've said this before recently, that I'm striving for a lifetime balance. And that isn't apparent in my day to day or week to week or month to month life, which is totally hectic and has its ups and downs. And it's so impossible to explain the high of being on top of Lhotse and skiing it, and then the low, the difficulties of coming back to real life and getting my mail and driving a car and all the sort of mundane things that I don't want to say depression, but it's hard. It's these big ups and downs that are part of my life. But I think I realize now that if I can strive for, like, lifetime balance, I'll be stoked on that. So, but the day to day is chaos, and the month to month is chaos, and I really like chaos. I get really bored when things aren't chaotic. So, yeah, there's that.
No, that's good. I mean, that's actually something we've talked about on the show before, like not having momentary balance, but having more of, like, this, you know, overarching umbrella, kind of a long-term balance where you know you're dedicating enough time to the right things over a period of time, but where in the moment there are certain things, whether it be kids or relationships or job or adventure, that need more attention than others. So that's totally okay.
Right. And I think kids are a really good example of this, like, my day-to-day chaos, but, like, over a time there's balance. And in that day-to-day, yes, I miss things that I really don't want to miss at their schools. Or the kids have to deal with some of that, like, sadness, that post-expedition sort of feeling of being lost. You know, they have to deal with that, the stress of me leaving on a trip, the just ups and downs of my travel, etc. But the overarching love that I have for them, and they know that, and that closeness that we have when you look over time is where I have to check in to make sure that we're all okay, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So do you that kind of ad hoc, or is it methodical? Like, every couple months you'll try to just do, like, a pulse check with yourself and then kind of with your key relationships or goals or what have you?
I would say it's more often than every couple months. I would say it's, you know, unless I'm gone on a long trip. I mean, 5 weeks on Lhotse is pretty long. Normally I'm gone, you know, 2 weeks here or 3 weeks tops. So I would say that there's that checking in, that sort of litmus test for that overarching wellness and balance every once a month. I'm not as cognitive or conscious of that as I am speaking about it right now, but it is definitely that check-in point of like, okay, do your kids feel loved? Are you nurturing your friendships? Have you had that conversation with your sister, with my sister? Like those kinds of things that are really important to me that I really need to check in with. I mean, and then of course there's like, did I pay my electricity bill? There's that kind of balance too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, when you're away, do you feel like, obviously you sound like you are at home in the mountains, and then you have that kind of lull when you get back and that post-expedition depression in a way of back to normalcy. But when you are in the mountains, are you kind of craving the normalcy? Or are you like excited to get back home?
Yeah, I am for sure. It's funny. And I think that contributes to the roller coaster a little bit of, you know, that the grass is greener syndrome of when I'm home, I'm sort of fantasizing and scheming about the next expedition and remembering like the purity and the presence and the excitement of being in the mountains in general, and that survival mode that I really love. And then when I'm in the mountains, I miss and long for having a glass of wine with my girlfriends, going skiing with my kids, taking a shower, sleeping in my bed, you know, those kinds of things. And I think when you put too much energy into thinking about these sort of opposite places of where you're at, they can't help but fall short when you actually are in them. So that's where a little bit of that roller coaster and depression comes from, in that I build these things up that to perfection. And then of course, when I get home, it's not perfect. And that's sort of, you know, that's what I struggle with sometimes. And eventually it evens out and there is balance in there. But yeah, that's definitely part of the struggle, is just sort of overreaching my expectations of the opposite of where I am.
I hear you. I subscribe to that too. My life is a constant push pull of the duality of the grass is always greener and the adventure versus the home life, and always expecting more than I should in both realms.
Really, I just right. Like the couch.
So. I know, right? Like the couch and my watching a movie on TV. It's so nice. But I mean, in the end, like the overarching thing I walk away with is that I think I'm so lucky to have both of those parts to my life. Yeah. And even though there's intermittent struggle on either end, and there's crazy high elated moments, and there's depression, etc., overall, those two different people that are inside of me, or those two different aspects of my life, really make me whole, and they really fill me out to I don't know, to just feeling lucky and I mean, I don't think I would change anything.
Wow, that's a great place to be. I like
place to be. And it's not perfect all the time, and I'm not happy all the time, and I don't need to be happy all the time. And it's just having these different influences in my life are really great.
Love that. Oh, I always try to do the test of like, well, always is a strong word maybe, but generally I try to do the test of, okay, if I'm like on my deathbed, am I going to be mad at myself for doing and going after this, or excited that I did that? Am I going to be mad that I missed out on this opportunity, or am I going to be, you know, whatever it is? And I think that's a good test too of like,
it's a good test.
What?
Yeah. Really good. It is. I mean, life is short.
Like, I don't know if I'll die on the bed, though. I will maybe die on a couch and watching Netflix.
So I'm curious, what kind of intentionality did you bring to designing your career, your lifestyle as an athlete? I mean, you obviously had this passion for the mountains that was so deeply ingrained in you that there was no question that this was what you were pursuing. But how did kind of the different pieces of it shake out as far as like what brands you might work with, or where you were making money here or there, or what kind of mindset or mental space you gave to media and films or photos or speaking? Not every athlete speaks, but a lot do. So how did you kind of design this mix for yourself?
I wish I could say I had more intention into it than I did. I think I put a lot of my intention and focus onto the actual expeditions and the climbing, and the style has always been really important to me, and just the learning that I get from it. And the career side of it in many ways was secondary.
Was there anything you were doing along the way to pay the bills before adventure was totally paying the bills?
I was living pretty hand to mouth for a while. I supplemented work with guiding. I did a lot of heli ski guiding. I had other jobs here in Telluride. I waited tables for a long time. I'm divorced now. When I was married, once I had kids, I pretty much stopped guiding, and because I couldn't balance all of those things anymore, being a mother, guiding, and being an athlete. So the guiding fell away at that point. And really, it was only in the last few years that I put a lot more intention into the career side of it, and into really caring about what I was saying and who I was working with, and understanding that because of that intention I put into the climbing and the mountaineering, it gave me a really good platform to create a job, essentially. I mean, as simple as that sounds, but to start making money and start having a voice in the environment, having influence as a mentor, all of these things became equally important, as important to me as did just that purity of climbing, which I was so solely focused on for so long. And I think that ties in with my kids just getting a little bit older and having a little more freedom and space in that relationship. And I feel like at some point I just reached this tipping point in my experience and through the expeditions and sort of the risks I've taken in that department. And that opened doors with National Geographic. It opened doors with Protect Our Winners to have a platform and end up in Davos and at the World Economic Forum in January, and like speaking about climate change and the things I've seen with my own two eyes. So when you speak about career, it doesn't just totally relate to money and income for me, although I'm doing much better in that department than I've ever done before. And a lot of that's because of speaking, but it also speaks to the other elements, being a mentor, and using my influence to inspire people to love the outdoors, and speaking about our world and what's going on in our world right now.
So did Protect Our Winners and Nat Geo and any of the, the sponsors, did they come knocking on your door because you were, doing amazing stuff out there in the mountains for so long, or did you actively pursue that?
I actively pursued. National Geographic was a part of that expedition where I climbed Lhotse and Everest, so the two 8,000 meter peaks. And that door was originally open for me through Conrad. And then I pursued it after that in terms of applying for a National Geographic grant and using that to then go to Myanmar on this crazy expedition. And then through that expedition, I've been able to travel around with National Geographic and be on their live series tour for, I'm going into my third season now. And the irony is that that was like the hardest, most insane expedition I've ever been on. And now I, you know, ironically just think that it speaks so well to every walk of life. And so it's become a really unique story to tell, even though it was like one of my most blow up expeditions. And then in terms of Protect Our Winners, that was a mutual connection. They sought me out and I sought them out. I had a lot of friends that were working with them. I'm friends with Jeremy Jones and I just really like what they do. But what they brought to me was a faith and a confidence in what I have seen in my voice that I didn't know I had, didn't know even existed. And so they have really helped me adventure into that realm.
That's awesome. So I can't imagine being in Davos and doing that. So what was that experience like coming from someone who's built their whole career and being in the mountains and then being in this really big public world stage?
It was crazy. It was really intense. I would give anything to be able to like go back and do it, have a second go at it, because I was just so nervous. But really, at the end of the day, I'm not reinventing the wheel. I am just talking about things that I have seen firsthand and experiences I've had with people that live in these certain places. And by telling those stories and getting comfortable with telling those stories, I feel like I am uniquely in the position to speak to people from all different walks of life. And that's exactly what Davos was. And while I was nervous and totally intimidated, I basically just told myself that, like, you're just telling your own story. And that's the powerful sort of easy way to share and to maybe influence a few people to reassess their thoughts about the world we live in.
It's kind of like the same way that you're talking about how you're talking yourself into like dropping into a line or
it is actually.
It's like, yeah. You got this. You have experience in doing this. You are the perfect person for this.
Right?
Yeah.
You are the candidate for this job.
So that's a great lesson in how outdoor adventure translates to other aspects of career and lifestyle.
Totally. No, that's.
It really does. I mean, and I think about that with my own kids, with like every generation growing up. It's like that connection with the outdoors and those experiences of falling down and busting your knee and getting a bloody cut on your forehead and getting up and keeping going and falling off your bike and failure and success. It's all so that decision-making, all those things are so tied in with being outside. And even if it's just a park in the city, something, you know, climbing a tree, like that gives you confidence. It gives you tools to deal with life, because life is hard. And, you know, for me, it's been a place, a refuge, really, to tackle all kinds of problems that life throws at me. So, yeah.
Well, I like that's, going. That is a perfect place to transition about, you know, culminating all of those experiences for you and where it's gotten you. And you said the word maybe, I don't know, 10 minutes ago, but it's stoke. And we ask every guest, what does stoke mean to you?
Oh gosh, stoke to me is this, like, it's physical. It's something that wells up from my stomach, and it comes up through my chest, and sometimes it gives me the chills, like the full chicken skin. And it's just like, it's like, I don't know, this beam coming out of my eyes when you just are stoked. And whether that's coming from somebody else's energy or it's because I did something that I didn't know I could do, or because I saw my kids succeed at something, I don't know. Stoke comes at surprising times. And I think that's what stoke is to me.
Awesome. And so yeah. Speaking of stoke, you have a couple, so you're involved in this National Geographic Speaker Series. You have some events coming up for that, right? So can you tell us a little bit about what that entails and where we can check it out?
Where our listeners can come hear you and your stoke.
Well, yeah, the funny thing is, I think when I do these speaker series, I get stoke from the audience energy. So I get really excited to talk to really good audiences. I was just in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is so, the cool thing about the Nat Geo thing is I get to go to all these crazy parts of my own country that I would never go to otherwise. So
how cool is Charlottesville? I love it there.
It is so cool. And the audience was just awesome. They were stoked. They just were so excited and like really interested in the stories and great questions and all that kind of stuff. So, but then tomorrow I go to Pittsburgh, hopefully, because I think it's pretty wintry and stormy. So hopefully I'll make it there. But that's for a Wednesday show. And I think after that, I'm in Park City, Utah. And the other cool thing is, through the connection of National Geographic, they're always in these really, really cool theaters. So Charlottesville was the Paramount. There's some, like the Perot Museum in Dallas was really amazing. I feel like I'm learning something every time. And it's funny getting up and telling these stories because I learn something or I remember something different every time. And the questions, I love the Q&A at the end because it really challenges me to be honest and transparent. And so that's what I'm doing. So if you're in Pittsburgh on Wednesday, come check it out.
Well, and I know you have a lot of these coming up through 2019 as well. So for anybody who wants to check it out, I know you can go to hillarynelson.com/events and figure out where you are and when. But the last thing I do want to ask you is now that, you know, Lhotse is done and you're moving into this new role with the North Face, and you have these, all the speaker series is coming up already booked and time blocked. Like when will you be ready or start thinking about what the next big objective is and when will you, you know, try and carve time out for that?
That is a good question. I'm surprisingly still pretty tired from Lhotse. Like I came back and had this sort of excitement bubble burst of energy that lasted for a few weeks. And then it was like a delay on the fatigue. So,
well, I don't think that's surprising.
Maybe not. I'm definitely lacking in motivation and the creativity. I like the creativity that goes into kind of planning and organizing these expeditions. So I still need a little time to figure that out. And I mean, right now I'm pretty excited. Like we talked about, sort of to figure out this captain role with North Face and get to interact with all the North Face athletes as much as I can. Cause I really appreciate that team and those influences. And beyond that, time feels very precious to me right now. So I am trying to be more present in it. And,
well, now that makes total sense.
Yeah. I'm really excited to be home and be in Telluride and ski here and cross my fingers. We continue with winter and, yeah, I don't know. I think, I have ideas of places I want to go and things I want to make happen. So, I just haven't quite put pen to paper yet.
Well, we'll be ready and waiting to cheer you on when you do. And if you need a little help brainstorming or a adventure buddy, I'm here for you.
Okay. That sounds great. Awesome. I might need that. I need a motivator right now. So
I will fill that role for you. cool. So, where can our listeners connect with you? Where's the best place? Where do you like to hang out and talk to people or share your adventures?
Mostly through Facebook, probably. That's a great place to message me. Instagram as well. I like to message on that kind of as it relates to different, photos or things, whatever that I put up there. Yeah.
That's just at Hillary Nelson on Instagram. Yeah. And you're,
yeah, Hillary Nelson on Instagram and same on Facebook. And, old fashioned email works for me too sometimes.
All right.
Nice.
Not as good with email as some of the other avenues.
No, email has a way of stacking up and becoming a to-do that falls off.
It does, doesn't it? Definitely sometimes.
Well, thanks so much, Hillary. We really appreciate you chatting with us tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And it was great. You guys had some great questions, so I appreciate that. Thanks.
One of the things that stood out to me in this interview with Hillary was when she was talking about how she thought something was wrong with her because she pursued and enjoyed suffering.
Yes.
And I've had those same thoughts.
Well, yeah.
I'm like drawn to things that are hard or that hurt. Yep. And in the moment, I'm like, why the hell am I here? Why am I doing this? but then I keep going back. It's some kind of addiction. And so I always wonder that. Like, what is this like sadistic thing inside of me that drives me to punishing myself in certain, you know, moments of suffering in the mountains or on whatever race or pursuit, whatever it is. And I loved kind of her spin on that and her take on how, like, you know, it really is a healthy thing, and it allows you not only to test yourself physically but mentally, and then through doing that you have a better appreciation of like, you know, yourself and your confidence and your purpose in mm-hmm. all this, right?
Yeah. When you were like, that's probably the thing that I associated with the most out of this interview, I was like, yep, that seems right. On brand, go for it. All right, let's do it. No, but I think that, I mean, there's so many lessons to be learned there. And I think that's the addiction, right? The addiction is you look at it back after and you're like, oh, I could have, or maybe I could have pushed myself harder, or I learned that I'm stronger than I thought, or I learned that I was mentally stronger than I thought, or whatever the lesson is. And then you come back and you're like, oh, I want to do that again because I want all those like profound things and thoughts to go into my head afterwards.
Totally.
I feel like that's the addiction. It's like, I like it. I don't love the idea of like my legs burning and like my forearms feeling like they're going to fall off or whatever the suffering is. But it's like the after that there's like this, it's rose colored glasses.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
obvious? Am I just stating the obvious? Probably.
No, you're right though. They're learning opportunities.
Yeah.
And that is what keeps you coming back because
yeah.
every time it's, you know, it might be the same pain. It might be, you know, could be a different, could be the same mountain or marathon or whatever it is for you. But it's never the same insights.
Yeah.
You learn something new every time. And it's just all like about personal development and pushing yourself to grow as a person by pushing yourself physically.
Yeah, I literally said this to my boyfriend Andrew, who I talk about quite often on this podcast.
Andrew, shout out.
Yeah, he's definitely not listening. and I said to him in the summer, I said, every time I go climbing, even though I have many a panic attack or many like moments where I'm frustrated, and as I get into the car when I'm done, I know that I've learned something. And whether that's like, oh, check your behavior, Emily, because you're like bringing down the aura around other people, and that's not fair and kind of selfish of you. Or if it's just like you are stronger than you think, like I mentioned, or, you know, that isn't as scary actually, or those just like tiny little moments. And it's stuff like that where it's almost like immediate. As you get in the car, you like close the door and you just like sit with what just happened. You're like, oh, okay, this makes sense. This makes sense why we're doing this. That's it. That's all I have to share with you.
Everybody's got their own, you know, personal reasons for pursuing things that might be painful in one way or another. And I mean, it takes doing it to learn what yours are, right? Like I didn't know for so long why I was drawn to those things.
Yeah.
And it has you question a lot about yourself, about your past, about your future and why, but I think in the end you're right. It's just about it's a way to learn about yourself.
Yeah, and so. I also took away that Hillary is badass woman. So I'm excited to see what she does with the North Face, being the team captain. I'm just excited to keep following her.
Yeah, she's fantastic. What's up?
I think that's the end of the outro. And thanks, everyone, for continuing to subscribe and listen and stuff. We really like you and love you. And
thanks for tuning into our weekly conversations, both the inspirational and motivational chats with our guests and our ridiculous
banter. The person
banter.
You found on the street called Emily Holland.
Yeah, and the I don't even know how you happened.
I don't know. And just the weird banter. Thanks, guys. See you later.